1 o'clock on Sportsnet 590. The Van Eric Smith, Paul Jones with you. A Thursday edition of Smith and Jones hits the air as we get you set for, well, another busy hour, another busy day in the world of sports, especially Toronto sports, coming off a big night last night for the Toronto Raptors and certainly the Toronto Blue Jays as well with their victory yesterday afternoon, which preempted us. So it's great to be back on the air after having the day off yesterday because of the Jays. And what better way to end it for the Toronto Blue Jays than a walk-off thanks to Bo Bichette. And we will discuss the Jays in about 10 minutes' time or so when Joe Siddle joins us, of course, from Blue Jays Central. And we'll break things all Blue Jays down with Joe, like I say, in about 10 minutes' time. And I'll tell you, I look at the start to the season for the Blue Jays, and I'll ask Joe about this, but as much as, you know, they're not necessarily setting the world on fire with their record to this point, to figure the way the Jays have come through over the opening, 10, 12 ball games of the season, sitting at 6-6, and I'm not, listen, 12 games in with 150 to go, I'm not going to worry about first place versus second versus last, whatever. A couple of days ago they were in last, now suddenly they're in second. That means nothing at this point. I don't know if a lot of us anticipated the Boston Red Sox being at 9-3. I think they're going to fall back down to earth at some point, especially when you look at that road record being 6-0 for the Red Sox. At some point that's going to change and probably find the Mendoza line, the water line, over the course of the year. But when I look at the Jays at 6-6, and I factor in, much like with the Raptors, having to play away from home, and it's a little bit better for the Jays in the sense that at least their home away from home is a familiar spot. It's their spring training facility. It's Dunedin. So there is at least a little bit more familiarity as compared to the Raptors going from Toronto to Tampa. But that said, it's still not home. It's still not Toronto. It's still not Rogers Center. And then I factor in the injuries, and then I factor in the questions about the pitching, which actually has been pretty good. And then combine that with the offense that we thought was going to be great, which has been kind of up and down. I think to be sitting at 6-6 and also to already have a leg up on the Yankees, to be 4-2 against the Yanks already through 12 games, and you've got a winning record head-to-head against them, I take it right now. Would I rather be better than 6-6? Sure. 7-5, 8-4, 9-3, whatever it may be, that'd be fantastic. But I'll take 6-6 right now, gearing up for the next series. And we'll talk to Joe all about that again in a couple of minutes' time when he joins us. And then later on in the show as well, we'll shift our attention from baseball to basketball. And we can get into stuff about the G League and the NBA as well. But we're going to have another member of the CEBL joining us, and he's the head coach and general manager of the Guelph Nighthawks. Charles Kissy will be on the program, and we're going to get into a bunch of stuff with him about the CEBL and the CEBL that held their U Sports draft yesterday as well. So lots to discuss with Charles. But staying on that topic for a second, that topic being basketball, I wanted to send out well wishes. I don't know that they'll get to him, but I'm going to send them anyways to LaMarcus Aldridge. And it's interesting to look back to that draft now 15 years ago. And I know our colleague Brad Fay was chatting about this, Jonesy, a little while ago earlier on Twitter. If you follow along on Twitter, you look back to the 2006 draft and take a look at the top picks and remember, the conversation at the time and the conversation for more than a decade now has been the number one pick. And, of course, that was the Andrea Bargnani draft year. And all of the chatter about Bargnani and Aldridge and Tyrese Thomas and others. Aldridge ended up having a career spanning 15 years, 7 All-Star appearances. The best player still standing from that draft is a Toronto Raptor to this day. And that's Kyle Lowry. But LaMarcus Aldridge announcing today, and I'll read just a portion of this. I'm not going to read the whole thing in case you're maybe hearing it for the first time. But Aldridge put up a post on Twitter, on Instagram as well earlier today. Today I write this letter with a heavy heart. My last game I played while dealing with an irregular heartbeat. Later on that night, my rhythm got even worse, which was really scary to him, etc. He goes on to say, the next morning I told the team what was going on. They were great about getting me to the hospital, getting me checked out. And though I'm better now, what I felt in my heart that night was still one of the scariest things I've experienced. With that said, I've made the difficult decision to retire from the NBA. For 15 years, I've put basketball first, and now time to put my health and family first. So again, retiring due to a regular heartbeat. And Jonesy, you start thinking about folks over the years. And listen, basketball's by no means exclusive to this club. It's happened to a lot of athletes in a lot of sports, and it happened to a lot of folks in everyday life. I'll tell you for you know, on a personal note, going back, I believe now 3 years ago, if not four, it might be 4 years this July, I went to the hospital on Canada Day what I thought was an irregular heartbeat, and it turned out to be what the doctors deemed a compensatory pause. That's what they diagnosed me with. It was nothing that I needed to be concerned about. I don't even know if you know this. I don't even know if I ever told you the story. But I was in emergency for a good 5-6 hours at a hospital in Oakville, dealing with this compensatory pause, which ultimately they told me, you don't need to worry about it. You don't need to freak out about it. You're going to live a fine life and just go about life. You're good to go. But when you start dealing with the heart, I start thinking about a guy like Aaron Gray, who the Raptors luckily discovered a heart issue with him that forced his retirement early. And then, of course, you go down the path of thinking about somebody like Reggie Lewis or Hank Gathers and other athletes that have unfortunately not been able to step away and before it was too late. And it's just, it's scary. And I think the way that Aldridge said it, Jonesy, is saying it best. It's time to put your health and family first and just to kind of look back now with fond memories of the career that was.
Eric, the first mention of something like that came to me when I was much younger, and it wasn't even in basketball. It was a young black lady who was an Olympic volleyball player, and her name was Flo Hyman, and she was one of the stalwarts on the U.S. women's Olympic team. And she died of something called Marfan syndrome. And it involves, if I'm not mistaken, I'm sure there's medical people listening, it involves an enlarged heart. And it took the life of this young lady who was a terrific volleyball player. And that was the first time that a heart issue jumped at me in sports. And it's scary. I mean, I saw the same Instagram post you did with LaMarcus Aldridge, and I think he said it right. You know, like, look after yourself first, look after your own health, because let's face it, if you don't have your health, you don't have anything. There's lots of people that have, you know, a whole lot of money and a whole lot of material possessions, but they're not healthy. And you know, we talk about how grateful we are for being able to, you know, do what we do and people to do what they do. But if you don't have your health, you can't do any of it. So good for LaMarcus Aldridge. I'm sure it's not, you know, sure it's not something that, you know, people ever want to see, a guy being forced to retire. But he's making a decision. He's had a great career, and he's making a decision for himself and his health. So I'm okay with that.
Yeah, I agree with you, Jonesy, and it actually leads me to another discussion. I said in our little group chat before the show that I was going to bring this up, and honestly, I didn't even know that if I was going down the path of LaMarcus Aldridge and the health this much, and didn't know that I was going to, you know, talk about my own situation as minor as it was from a few years ago. But it kind of again bridges the gap to something that I did want to discuss, and hopefully he doesn't mind me saying this. I don't think he does. And even if he does mind, well, he already put it out publicly in black and white on Twitter. So, hey, it's for public consumption now. Our friend, our colleague, Leo Routens, sent this out yesterday, Jonesy. And this was a retweet, or a quote tweet, I suppose, is the technical term, to the news that had come out of Boston yesterday. And it was Jason Tatum post-game after their game on the 13th discussing how he is still dealing with COVID-19 and the after effects and the effects on his body, and the fact that he now uses an inhaler for breathing both before and after the game to try and clear the lungs and to get proper breaths and whatnot. And it's kind of been a lot of chatter in Boston and around the NBA. And what Leo said in retweeting this, or quote tweeting this story, he said, "For all you Raptor fans who feel that COVID is used as an excuse, wake up. This blank is real. Potentially altering and deadly. So until you walk in another man's shoes, be quiet." And I think what Leo was referencing, or I know what Leo was referencing, is a lot of fans that maybe are pointing fingers or sending little jabs at whether it's Pascal Siakam or Fred VanVleet or DeAndre Bembry or Paul Watson or anybody else that's dealt with COVID or health and safety protocols, and the fact that they're struggling, they don't look as good, they're not playing as well. What's the problem? What's the issue? And the the vitriol and the animosity that seems to be up there. And Jonesy, I'm not gonna reveal this person's name because it's not my place to do so, and I also didn't ask permission to use their name. But I'm gonna share with you a story here, and the reason I'm doing this right now, folks. And again, I'll say this, as you've said before, Jonesy, and we've referenced a number of times in the show, some people might be throwing their hands up in the air right now saying, enough. And others are probably saying, yes, go, use the platform. And I'm speaking to the people then that are saying, yes, use the platform, because everything we are all still dealing with, you saw the numbers today. For the first time, over 4,000 new cases, and we're almost at 5,000, folks, over 4,700. We're now in a worse situation than many of or most of the U.S., and we used to be pointing fingers at the U.S. and not necessarily laughing. We were scared for what was happening to the folks in the U.S. Well, we are now worse than them in the situation that we're in, at least in this province specifically. So it's time to start waking up, folks. Look in the mirror, do your part, and be mad, be angry, be saddened, but be motivated by the fact that right now we're in a worse position than we were a year ago. And that's pathetic. I'm going to share with you something, and you know this person, Jonesy. Again, I'm not going to tell the person's name, but I know somebody that I just found out today that is dealing with COVID-19. He is extremely fit. And when I talk about extremely fit, he is in fitness competitions. The dude is an Adonis. And he's dealing with COVID-19 right now. And I'm going to read you word for word the WhatsApp exchange that I had with him when I sent him well wishes and hoping that he was doing well. He says, "It's been crazy. I would have never imagined that it could be this bad. I'm starting to slowly come around, which is a relief, but I appreciate the support. Say hi to the family for me." And then when I followed up and said, you know, again, hope you're doing well. Thanks for getting back to me, et cetera. Hang in there, blah, blah, blah. He says, "I'm on day 9 of feeling like hell. It's hard to want to eat, let alone do anything when you feel like this." Now, we're talking about a guy, again, that is like the epitome of health. But he's just a regular everyday Joe for the most part. Try and apply that now, what I just wrote, and take that. Even if, and listen, thank goodness he hasn't had to be hospitalized. He hasn't been on a ventilator. He hasn't been on death's door. Now take that and apply it to a professional athlete, right, Jonesy? That's now going to go out there and try and come back and play at the top of his or her game and have to perform at the same level that he or she did 15 days ago, 30 days ago, a year ago, when they were an all-star, when they were elite, when they were whatever, let alone the mental component of all this, trying to deal with having COVID, recovering from COVID, trying to get back to everyday life, get back to fulfilling your contract and playing at a level, let alone the mental. Put that aside. Just the physical alone. I read that today, and it made me think of Leo's tweet, and it made me think of what Pascal or Fred or Teoscar Hernandez or whomever else might be going through trying to come back from all this. And we just don't know. And I'll tell you what, I hope I never know. Because selfishly, yeah, I don't want to get COVID. I don't want to deal with this. But we just don't know. And this, again, to me, was another slap-in-the-face realization of, because it's a personal connection, of how bad this thing can really be.
It's awful. And again, these are the stark reminders, Eric, for people that think, oh, this is, you know, this is fake, or it's a hoax, or it can't be that bad. And I, like you, I've known people that have had it that you would never think that it could strike them down, fit, healthy, the prime of their life. And then I've known other people that have contracted it, and you look at them as they might be compromised, as they're much older, yet they said, "Oh, I had a few sniffles and I felt like I had a sore throat and that was it, and I got through it." So it just impacts people differently. It does. And it's scary. And I think it's, you know, as we continue to say, it's got to be taken seriously. I don't think you can stop living your life, but at the same point, I don't think you can be anywhere close to something resembling reckless or dismissive of this thing. And look, we're going to be dealing with it for a long, long time to come.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well said, Jonesy. And the Toronto Blue Jays currently dealing with it as well as they try to navigate their way through the first few weeks of the season. And it's going to be something that I'm sure they'll be dealing with and navigating as you know, all professional sports teams will be, as we all are, period, in society, for the weeks and months to come. as they travel around and try to do this thing in baseball as safe as possible, much like hockey has done and the National Football League and the NBA as well. To talk about the Toronto Blue Jays and the start to the season, again, 6-6 following the heroics last night or yesterday afternoon from Bo Bichette with the walk-off home run, is a former major leaguer and, of course, Blue Jays analyst as well from Blue Jays Central, Joe Siddall. Joe, appreciate the time today.
Hey, good afternoon, fellas. It's always good when you take two out of three from the Yankees, isn't it?
It really is. And I was, you know, Joe, I was saying that off the top, Joe, that the good thing is you look at the 6-6, and I said, listen, I'll take that after 12. I'll take the 6-6 considering everything Toronto's been through, and we can dive into that, Joe, and break it all down. But hidden in that 6-6, or maybe not so hidden, standing out is the fact 4-2 against the Yanks, taking two out of three twice against the Yankees in the opening 12. That certainly is an even greater thing looking forward to, you know, mid-season, end of the season, when we talk about tiebreakers and head-to-heads and whatnot.
Yeah, now that we've seen some of this head-to-head, you know, I was feeling going into the season, the poor Tampa Bay Rays don't get any props. Nobody talks about the Rays going into the season. Meanwhile, they just went to the World Series. You know, they lose Blake Snell and they lose Charlie Morton. So I had my question marks there. But when you looked at the Yankees, after Gerrit Cole, I thought there were an awful lot of question marks with that pitching staff, especially the rotation, and now we got to see it with Tyone and Kluber. I mean, these guys aren't what they once were. And after that, there are more question marks. So when you look at the issues that the Blue Jays were having with injuries and the way they're getting through it, they are right with the Yankees and then some. Yankees bullpen can be good at times, so can the Blue Jays. And I do think the Yankees lineup is going to hit. They've been off to a terrible start. The Blue Jays lineup has been off to a pretty slow start, too, before coming around. So the point of it, though, is after seeing the Yankees head-to-head, I don't think they should scare the Blue Jays at all. Blue Jays fans should say bring it on, because that's not the team that we should be talking about in the AL East the way they're looking right now.
Joe, I want to back up a little bit. And, you know, sometimes you just have a guy's number, right? Like, there's that season where you just – I mean, I look at the Raptors. They're struggling this season, but, you know, the Detroit Pistons have like 15, 16 wins or whatever it is. They got three against Toronto. And like, is this it for Toronto? Might they just have the Yankees number this year? And one, and two, Joe, when I look at it, how important was it to take two out of three with the wheels kind of wobbling after the first series against New York and you know, what happened in Texas and stuff like that? How important was it to do what they just did?
Well, I think when you play well against a team, and maybe they get up for the Yankees, much like a lot of teams probably do, but they seem to play them tough in past years, you know, and they really are very competitive with them, even on the Blue Jays down years. But yeah, with what they've been through, and especially if you think of the start of the day yesterday, when you've got Merriweather going to the IL and Stripling can't make the start. I mean, you're right. The wheels were way wobbly. And then there's a day that you beat the New York Yankees 5-4 the walk-off, and TJ Zoik gives you four on a day he didn't know what he was pitching. But more importantly, how about the bullpen? And I won't even go to Dolis because he's a guy you expect it from, but four shutout innings from Trent Thornton and Castro. Had you ever even heard of Castro? You know, that's the guy they picked up off waivers, and they come in. But Trent Thornton sneakily had a couple of nice outings. And I say sneakily because he had his ups and downs as a starter. Then he battled injury himself. What pitcher doesn't? But the way he's come back, I think he's in a nice little role. Bring him into that game when you're maybe down a run and you're just asking him to keep it close. And he did that. Two great innings. Castro did the same thing. And when your team is down a run like that or two in a ball game, that's your job out of the bullpen. I know as a catcher calling the game, you tell your pitcher, hey, let's keep it right here because you want to give your lineup a chance. And it was mapped out perfectly. That's exactly what the bullpen did. So a tough day injury-wise, but wow, what a day. And you end up beating not the Corey Kluber that he once was, but you beat Corey Kluber and the Yankees with some unheralded heroes for sure out of that bullpen.
Speaking with Joe Siddall from Blue Jay Central. Joe, you just mentioned a couple of the names, but I'm going to follow up again. You know, you're already without Springer and Pearson and others. I talked about Hernandez earlier in my little diatribe about COVID, but now Stripling and Merriweather. For one day, it looked good, and it was certainly great, as you just laid out. Moving forward now for this next series against Kansas City, moving forward for the next week or so, how do you think the Jays, Charlie Montoya, how do you manage this and work around all of the injuries and how it impacts your rotation, your lineup, your bench, everything?
Well, you hear managers talk and you hear general managers use the word depth so much. They do it in the off season, they do it in spring training, and then they do it during the season. And that depth is being called into question right now, right? You have to keep throwing guys out there. And especially when it comes to pitching, I mean, it's one thing to lose George Springer, your new free agent acquisition. That's a huge loss. And then Teoscar, who got off to a bad start, and now he's out. So lineup-wise, oh, those are killers. So they're just going to have to try to tread water and do some things like they did yesterday until they get their big boys back. But on the pitching front, yeah, it's almost next man up. And let me tell you, there's no team in baseball that's going to feel sorry for you because everybody's going through it. The injury list and all sports, I think, it's just been ridiculous. But pitchers and their arms, you've got to go next guy up, and, you know, Stripling serves. So Zoik comes in, and, you know, TJ Zoik's not going to win any Cy Young Awards, but if he can just give you some innings, and I think that's what's important this year because you're playing 100 more games than last year after the pandemic shortened season. I mean, you're talking about, what, 900 innings now that you have to cover that you didn't have last year? Guys had smaller workloads last year. So you need innings, and that's what TJ Zoik did yesterday. He gave them innings, and, you know, Hatch is out. Anthony Kay, Hatch, Zoik, those were your depth starters that I thought would probably be at the alternate site or in AAA building their pitch counts up so that if they needed them at the big league level based on either injury or poor performance, that they're available. Well, Hatch is hurt. Zoik has already been called in. And I think the answer is Anthony Kay. We don't know yet what they're doing in Kansas City. I haven't heard anything. There are options like going to a bullpen day. You can use a Malone and a Roark and these guys. I'm not a fan of that myself, and the reason I'm not a fan of it is you start burning arms down there in game one of a four-game series. I would rather bring up a guy that, and I don't know this for sure, what Anthony Kay has been doing, but it's my understanding he's at the alternate site building up. So I don't see why he wouldn't come up and hopefully give you five or six innings against the Royals tonight. And you hand it over to the bullpen and keeps that bullpen from going into disarray, right? When you use all these relievers in a game, now what happens the next day if your starter struggles early? So you just create a lot more problems for yourself. So depth is here. Keep doing it and keep bringing it as next man up. But I'm hoping to see Anthony Kay. I've liked him at times.
Joe, you know, you talk about you caught my ear there with the comment about the bullpen. I mean, they're going to be the lifeline, and you don't want to wear them down. But at the same time, it sounded to me it's very commonplace in the NBA when you get an injury, you try to have least disruption. So even though somebody thinks player A might step into the starting lineup, you go to player C or D to keep, you know, the second unit intact. How does Charlie manage without wearing out the bullpen? And as you know, as you kind of hinted at, having least disruption possible going forward.
Well, what you said, Jonesy, about the bullpen being the lifeline, I'm going to go the other way. I think your starting rotation's your lifeline because they're the ones that determine how good your bullpen could do. And when you look at what Ryu has done, and you look now at Matt's already in a couple starts, and Robbie Ray was impressive in his first start. If your starters can give you innings and take you into the sixth inning, it allows your big boys down there to do their job at the back end, and it allows your middle guys to come in their roles. It keeps everybody in their role, and it keeps everybody from burning out. Because if your starters aren't going deep early in the season, we saw it last year. It was a different season last year, but when the starters are scuffling and you're calling upon those guys in the bullpen too often early, they're going to burn out by June and July. And this is going to be a long one. This season is going to be a marathon and then some. And I joked the other day, I said that anybody that had a pitcher that had a Blue Jays uniform on in spring training, I think there were 60-something guys, any of those pitchers, though, they're probably going to pitch for the Blue Jays at some point this year because they're going to need every arm available. So the starters are huge, and that's why I'm more of a fan of using like an Anthony Kay tonight, because if he's built up and ready, he should be able to come give you five or six innings. Right. And again, it keeps everything in order and it doesn't burn out the bullpen guys. You don't want the Romanos and DeLises, well, Merriweather's already out, but you don't want those guys burning out early. You want them staying in those late inning roles and just doing it when called upon, as opposed to having to do it more often than not because your starters are going two and a third.
Speaking with Joe Siddle from Blue Jay Central. Joe, perfect transition for me to ask you about, speaking of burning out, it's only 12 games in, we're only a couple of weeks in. And I understand why. Not only are they your best players, but you also don't have a lot of options because of all these injuries we've been discussing. At what point do you think you get a day off for a Bo Bichette or Vladimir Guerrero Jr., for even at this point, Grichuk and Simeon, all these guys, all of them that I just mentioned, those are the four that have played every single game thus far. Is that a concern, do you think, when you talk about burnout and whatnot? Or is it, hey, we need you and you got to play, period?
Well, the joy in baseball is you do get days off. Unfortunately, this is a real busy stretch for the Blue Jays, 16 straight. So they need to get through this weekend. They've got 2 days off next week, and they've got 2 days off the following week. So those can't come soon enough. But one way Charlie has done it is by DHing them. And, you know, you can DH Vladdy yesterday. It gets him off his feet. And to me, it was a little bit twofold. It gets Vladdy off his feet for a day, but it also gets Rowdy back in there at first base rather than just being a DH. Because he's battling a lot of things too, struggling with the bat early in the season. I think Bo's DH today, you know, so you try to spread that around a little bit. But I think what Charlie does really well, and he says as much, that he communicates with his players very well. And you have to, because there might be a day that Grichuk might say, you know what, my knee's barking a little bit. A DH day would be great today, or that sort of thing. And you hope players can be honest with you. And you hope that you create that relationship, that they are honest with you. So I think that's one thing Charlie does very well. He's an old teammate of mine, and he was like that 30 years ago. He's just a very good communicator. He's sincere, and he wants to know. If you're ready to go, great. If you need a day off, great. Like, and that's what I think he'll build that relationship with his players. And really today, guys, that's what managing is. You're managing personalities. You're managing relationships, and that's one department that I think Charlie's very good. I'm not in the clubhouse, so I don't know how that works day in and day out, but it sounds like even the way he talks and says to the media, you know, how he handles his players, that's the right way to go about it in this business, and especially, as you mentioned, in a busy stretch like the one they're in now.
Hey, Joe, we appreciate the time as always. Thanks for joining us today and breaking it all down. Enjoy the KC series.
All right, guys. Have a great weekend, too.
Thanks, Joe.
There is Joe Siddall, former major leaguer and, of course, analyst with Blue Jays Central, as the Jays get set for their first tonight against the Kansas City Royals. As you can hear it, of course, right here on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. First pitch going just after 8 o'clock. And that was a thrill yesterday, Jonesy, watching Bo Bichette step up and blast that homer and win it on a walk-off for the Jays. I mean, it's funny. It's still one of the great moments in sports, period. You know, and unfortunately, we don't see it enough, but the buzzer beater in basketball, the walk-off in baseball, and we saw both yesterday. One was obviously from a selfish Toronto perspective, but how about that buzzer beater for Luka Doncic as well? That was ridiculous what he did for Dallas. Just the awkward, you know, the way he had to just fling his body sort of leaning forward over the three-point arc to win it for the Mavs at the buzzer. It's just, those are the moments that keep bringing you back as a fan to sports.
It's interesting because, you know, hockey calls it sudden death overtime. And I sometimes think about the other way, sudden life. Like, yeah, it's death for one team, but like, you know, it's game seven and, you know, Kawhi makes the buzzer beater or, you know, there's an overtime goal in the NHL playoffs or, you know, it's the ALCS and it's extra innings and there's a walk-off home run. All of a sudden that team that was able to do that, they got four more games. Like they're still alive. Like the music is stopped for the other guy and you say, sorry, you know, sad to see you go, but I'm still out here dancing. And it is one of the great things in sports when you get to that, when, you know, like the buzzer beater in basketball, the overtime goal in hockey, the, you know, the last second field goal in football, those kinds of things, that just the finality of it all is a great, great part of our industry.
It absolutely is. Again, first pitch for the Jays tonight against Kansas City right here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan, coming just after 8 o'clock. The Toronto Raptors not playing tonight following the back-to-back on Tuesday, Wednesday, their victory last night over DeMar DeRozan and the San Antonio Spurs. So certainly a busy weekend coming up for the Raptors, as they will play again on Friday and then coming up again on Sunday. Still trying to stay in the thick of things in that battle in the Eastern Conference for that 10th seed. And, of course, a lot of eyes focusing on the Toronto Maple Leafs. They're in action tonight as well down at Scotiabank Arena playing host to the Winnipeg Jets. Puck drop at 7 o'clock. When we continue, onto the hard court. We go from baseball to basketball, and we'll talk about the CEBL and much more, because I think there's a bigger conversation we can get into with our next guest as well, and we'll tell you who and what when we come back on Smith & Jones on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Welcome back to Smith & Jones on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Eric Smith, Paul Jones with you. Thanks to Joe Siddle for joining us to start the program. We shift our attention now from baseball, from the field onto the hard court. And joining us on the line right now, general manager and head coach of the Guelph Nighthawks of the CEBL, Charles Kissy. And Charles, first of all, welcome to the show and thanks for joining us. But I guess we have some breaking news as well in the last 35 minutes with a major signing for your team as well.
First of all, I'll say the cat is out of the bag, but thank you. Yeah, I've been holding on to that one. Thank you for having me. It's an absolute honor to be here.
Well, and the cat that's out of the bag, as Charles just says, is the team has just announced the signing of NBA G League guard Cat Barber, who now joins the Nighthawks. And this is an interesting one, because I'll tell you, when I look at this, Charles, correct me if I'm wrong, you start seeing some of these names that are signing with the CEBL now, and some of the with due respect to all the players, but some of the higher profile names that are coming, whether it be from overseas and from the G League and former NBA draft picks as well. There's a lot of talent that's coming into this league, and I look at a guy like Cat and think, this guy's got a legit chance to be, like, we're talking MVP-type caliber. He's one of the good young players in the game, period. And now to bring a caliber of his type to the CEBL, that's huge for Guelph, period, but for the league overall.
Yeah, 100%. I think you hit it on the head. I mean, the league is getting better. I think when you think about the work that's being put in, you know, Mike Morreale, who's and his whole staff have done a fantastic job of building it to this point. I think all of the GMs are working really hard and presidents to try to create a product that, you know, Canadians can be proud of, that, you know, that, you know, Canadians can play in and can be, you know, next up as far as leagues go. Right. I mean, I think there's the NBA and there's some really high level, you know, leagues overseas, but we want to be, you know, the next one up as far as, you know, places to play and producing high-level talent. And I think Cat is it's a huge pickup for our league, a huge pickup for us. Obviously, we're pretty excited about it. But that's where the league is trending, and I think that's what that speaks to.
Charles, I think it's great, and I want to go in another direction in a minute with you here, but first of all, we have to be careful because you and I talk all the time, and we have to remember now,
sure,
people are listening to
sure
us. We're on the radio, Charles. And when I think about a couple of stops earlier in your career as the head coach at Brock and how you helped revive the program there, the CEBL is perfect because you had so many guys that were on your teams. You developed them after, you know, 4 years of university ball, and then there's nowhere to play. And this is,
right,
I think it's fantastic that the CEBL is here. And then you start getting guys like Cat and, you know, Diamond Stone and these guys that, you know, we had Justin on the other day. These guys that are, you know, NBA draft picks coming to play in the CEBL. That's because you're not that far from the NBA. You're in their sight lines. It's not like you're going to somewhere way off in Europe or South America. So I think the league is really viable in that sense. And I, you know, people like yourself getting head coaching experience and what you bring from, you know, 905 and places like that, I think is terrific. But Charles, you also bring something from your other life, and people may not know that before you got into this basketball thing, you were a police officer. And with all that's going on in the world now, and again, you and I have talked many times, not in front of these microphones about that kind of stuff. How do you kind of relate some of that and bring some of that into what you're doing now to try and just help shape people and have them recognize bias and try to make this world a better place?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, outside of our Equity Connections company that we've created to help people do that very specifically, I think in basketball, as far as coaching goes, it's, you know, and Jamal Malala is like the biggest proponent of this. It's about people, you know, and it's about helping to develop, you know, young men and women, young athletes, not just from, you know, putting that orange round thing and that orange round thing, you know, the dribble pass shoot stuff, but also helping them you know, grow as individuals in terms of, you know, their values and what's important and priorities. I think, you know, in this current state, you know, I think a lot of conversations, I mean, thinking back to last summer series where, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about these issues. We spent, you know, we had team meetings where we're like every team, I'm sure, or maybe not, but we're having these conversations. Hopefully people were, and hopefully people continue to have these conversations about, you know, race and equity and inclusion and so on and so forth until it becomes habit, part of the way we live daily. And we're not there yet. But certainly for me, it's important. It's infused. And, you know, I talked to our team president, Cameron, who's a super supporter and ally. And we talk about it all the time in terms of our staff. What does it look like? How are we representing ourselves, our organization, the league, you know, our medical staff? We're being very intentional about making sure that we're diverse, and not just racially diverse, but, you know, all of the above, you know, name it, whether it's gender, whether it's, you know, religion, whatever it is, but finding, you know, the qualified people with diverse backgrounds to add value to our experience. I know at Brock, it was important to have a diverse team so that the student athletes could learn from each other and learn from their different backgrounds and, you know, and share in them wherever they came from. That's part of the growing experience. It's part of our learning as young humans, and we have to continue to merge, share with each other, and find ways to, you know, listen and grow from each other. I think it's such an important piece for me. It's like, you know, I just won't move forward without it. I refuse to. I think, you know, in the past, oftentimes you're trying to get in and fit in and figure it out. And I think, you know, I've made a very grounded decision to make sure that I'm overly thoughtful about how I proceed with my coaching and how that impacts my coaching and working with other coaches and other athletic departments and so on to help them, you know, figure out this inclusion piece and figure out this equity piece. It's just far too important in every segment. I mean, I have a podcast now, Think About It. That's online, and that's what we discuss. I just think it's so important that we don't stop having these conversations and you know, you're seeing what's happening around the world. We're not there yet. And so we have a long way to go, but we got to continue these conversations, and we have to be very open to them. You know, I think one of the hardest pieces is people sometimes aren't open-minded. We're not willing to listen to differences of opinions or thoughts, and we have to continue to find ways to do that.
Speaking with Charles Kissy, general manager, head coach of the Guelph Nighthawks of the CEBL, for what it's worth, Charles, I know I speak on Jonesy's behalf that I would echo all of those sentiments that you just said. And working alongside Paul for over 20 years now, and just even Jonesy in the last, 6 to 12 months, the amount of times I've heard him say, and I'm in lockstep with him, that the conversation needs to continue to happen because it hits the news cycle, it hits the headlines, and it maybe takes a week or two or maybe less, and all of a sudden goes away before the next thing happens, and then we start talking about it again, and then it goes away. So I think it needs to be something that's front of mind for all of us, no matter our race or gender or otherwise. And in mentioning that, Charles, when it comes to your role with Guelph and in your previous stops at Brock and in the G League, wherever it may be, just in life in general, you're still a young man yourself. You celebrated a birthday last week, but you're still a young man yourself. How have you taken on, or how challenging has it been maybe at times to take on that role of mentor for so much of your life for younger people? Because I've got to imagine you're getting people from different walks of life, whether it be in Canada, in the U.S., European players, whomever it may be, that are coming to you and coming from different backgrounds and different upbringings and different countries, period, different lives, but many dealing with the same issues and just trying to speak to them on a human level, on a mentor level, beyond just your role as a coach.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. I started policing when I was 22 years old. So you're asking me at 22, or they asked me at 22 to, you know, basically go solve people's problems. And, you know, I wasn't married, and I'm dealing with domestics, and I wasn't, you know, so things like that. You have to figure it out. I mean, for me, I made a very conscious effort to always, I would say my parents were great at making sure I treated everyone the same. I was respectful and regardless of their situation dynamic, and try to invest in people. I think that was always part of my my upbringing, and now it's no different. It's you know, my policing experience sort of taught me that. Invest in people. It doesn't matter what they're going through or, you know, where they're at. Invest in them, get to know them, and find ways to relate. And so no different, you know, in coaching, right, where it's about people. You know, you want them to you know, buy into something, or you want them to run faster or jump higher, whatever it is. Well, invest in them, get to know them, you know, find ways to learn what motivates them, you know. And it takes a while to understand that, because we often see coaching as, you know, X's and O's and wins and losses. And sure, at the highest levels, that's important, without a doubt. But I always feel like, and I've always felt like, the great ones, regardless of whether it's coaching or business or wherever, they figure that piece of it. They figure out the human element. You know, they figure out how to, you know, get into people and speak to their core, and you know, find ways to understand their motivation, not just how to motivate them, but understand what their motivation is. And so for me, that's kind of been my focus of coaching. It's like, I love the X's and O's, but I'm more passionate about the people. And so that's kind of how I do it. I think for me, it's about, yeah, you know, just really staying true to that and being genuine. I always tell people the story of, like, Tyler Ennis. Oftentimes, you know, we'd have film sessions with the 905, and a lot of the film sessions, we would just be talking about life, you know. We would just be talking about where he's at and, you know, what his future aspirations are, and, you know, other things. You know, sometimes it was not, you know, the computer screen would be open, but we would be having conversations about other things. And I think, you know, that's why we still talk today. So I think that's, I guess, to answer your question, long-winded way, but for me, that's what it's really about.
Yeah, no, Charles, it's true. And, you know, like, we talk about this all the time. People see X's and O's in coaching, and it's very much like any leadership role, teaching, you know, being an administrator in a school, being, you know, I had the joy of being around some doctors and frontline workers this morning, and it's about, as you say, investing in people and helping to learn motivation and create a better society, functioning people in society that are looking out for one another. And I know you got some of that in your background from your upbringing too, because you saw a lot of that. How much of that stuff helped shape you too, Charles? That, you know, just your background growing up and where and all of that. How much of that helped, you know, motivate you and drive you forward in that regard?
Oh, I mean, for me, a lot of it. I mean, if you look, I mean, right now, you know, I'm living comfortably. I'm doing well for myself. If you think about, you know, I grew up in Regent Park in downtown Toronto. I think a lot of people would say, would I be on the Fan 590 with Jonesy and Smith, like, you know, at any age? You know, they'd say, no way. Like, I would have said no way, because, you know, where I was from, people weren't doing that. We always talk about representation, you know. That wasn't really happening, you know. And I think even about both of you guys, you know, people are now looking up to both of you as, you know, as this is something they can do. You know, Jonesy, people are looking at you like this is something you could do, whether you were teaching or in your current role. I think, you know, growing up, I was fortunate to see it in glimpses. You know, there was a teacher that I always tell people this story of a teacher I never had. He, for some reason, he reminded me, and I don't know if he actually did, but he looked like Martin Luther King in my mind at that age. I was in primary school at Winchester Public School, and he looked like Martin Luther King. That was the first thought of me ever wanting to be a teacher, which I now sort of do at Humber College. But I had never thought about really any careers that way. One of my first thoughts of being a police officer was seeing another individual, older black man at 51 Division, who was very kind. States, his name was, his last name. And I remember him, you know, we'd have some interactions at like a fair or something like that. They used to have these community fairs. And, you know, that was the first thought of ever wanting to be a police officer. Before that, in Regent Park, the police were like, you know, you didn't talk to them. They were like, exactly, you know, they were, yeah, public enemy number one. That's how I grew up, right? But seeing that representation sort of helped me think about it differently. Okay, maybe I can, you know, affect change. Maybe I can, you know, mold this relationship a little bit differently. Maybe I can actually treat people a little nicer, and maybe it creates a positive impact. I'm not saying they're all negative, but there was certainly a negative perception, and there still is, obviously, and in some cases for very good reasons. So, you know, I think growing up the way I did, I was lucky enough to sort of see those moments. And let me not take away from my siblings. I'm the youngest, right, of many, and all of my older brothers and sisters were such a great influence for me. They were my early representation, right? So I got to see them, you know, succeed, but I also got to see them struggle in many ways and think, not going down that road, you know, and sort of figure it out. They've all are doing awesome now, but I just think, you know, that whole sort of village to raise a child piece was certainly in effect when I was growing up, but not certainly not easy. A lot of the things that people talk about today, the biases, the people, you know, I remember I had friends that parents wouldn't let them play with me because I was living in Regent Park. Like, those types of things, they're very real, you know, and they impact people and kids, and they exist today, obviously. But I was always one of those that, you know, I was going to change this. You know, that was just my mindset. I was just going to figure it out and change it. And that was just how I'm sort of, to some people's dismay, still that way. So it was a beautiful thing. I actually, you know, when you're young, you kind of like, oh, you don't want to tell people, you know, you grew up in Ridgeway, you're living in Ridgeway Park. It was kind of a thing. Almost a stigma. And as I've grown older, I'm like super proud of it, because I know I would have been a different human being if I wasn't there. You know,
Charles, listen, we really appreciate you sharing the stories and the insight today. And I'll say, just, you know, and kind of in a lighthearted way, but based on something you said a couple of minutes ago, man, when COVID's over and it's safe and healthy and proper and whatever to do so, forget coming on as a guest for 10 minutes. You come in and co-host the show for an hour or two. I mean,
I'll sit back
and listen to you speak for an hour, man. You can do this. You could do this in your sleep too. So add this to your resume. You got future broadcaster in you as well. So
I'm going to say this, and knowing Charles the way I do, he is, even for people that are in front of him on the road, and I look, age-wise, I look back at him, and he's an inspiration. The things that he's done, and it kind of epitomizes, don't let anything in your past define you. If you drive looking backwards, there will be an accident. Keep your eye on the road ahead and keep going, keep moving. Just like Martin Luther King said, if you can't fly, run. If you can't run, walk. If you can't walk, crawl. Whatever it is, do what you got to do to keep moving forward. And Charles, my friend, you are a prime example of that, my man. And I am pleased to call you my friend.
I appreciate you both. Thank you very much. And I'm going to take you up on that co-hosting offer and anything.
Yeah,
else.
Give us a day off. It'll give us a day off, man. One of us, anyway.
I appreciate you both. Thank you so much for having me on.
All right, Charles, all the best. Thanks very much. There's Charles Kissy, the general manager, head coach of the Guelph Nighthawks of the CEBL. Their season set to begin on Tuesday, June 8th, where they'll face the Hamilton Honey Badgers. And yesterday in the U Sports draft, Guelph going out and nabbing three players with the third overall pick. Isaiah Osborne from Carleton, Jordan Henry out of McMaster was their second pick, Cole Long their third pick from Memorial University. We've got to take the break. We'll come back, get you teed up for Baseball Central, which is coming up shortly right here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Back on Smith & Jones. Thanks again to Charles Kissy for joining us on the show today. Joe Siddle as well. Baseball Central is coming up next. But Jonesy, I know you had a parting shot for today.
Yeah, I did. And, you know, we say it all the time and people forget about it and it gets worn out. But just want to continue to thank the frontline workers. I was in an area of the city today where, let's say, an underserved community. And the frontline workers were just doing amazing things there. It almost brought me to tears. And in particular, I'd like to recognize Dr. Jordan Solomon, who was out there kind of looking like the Duke defense, clapping his hands, you know, egging, inspiring people, you know, pushing them on, pushing them forward and impacting lives. So, you know, thanks to him. And like I said, all those frontline workers that were in that area of the city that I was in today, absolutely tremendous.
Thanks to all of you for tuning in today, and thanks to our crew. We're back again tomorrow at 1 o'clock Eastern. Baseball Central is next right here on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.